We now have a new challenge, perhaps the most monumental in recorded history. The opportunity to investigate a phenomenon that could change our destiny. A look at ourselves 1,000 years in the future.
We're going to examine and perhaps question some widely held theories of what may have happened to this Earth of ours. We're going to investigate some strange and bizarre events in the present. Unbelievable happenings as fresh as today's headlines. And more important, perhaps, we're going to take a searching and scientific look into the future. We're reaching more and more out into space. Perhaps, as we may learn, someone, something, somewhere in space is reaching out to us.
Who the visitors are, where they're from, and what they want is unknown.
Bigfoot was attracting national attention and was now rapidly becoming the most intriguing mystery on the North American continent. Scientists and photography experts have examined the individual frames of this film and have come to the conclusion that the film and the creature are authentic.
Telepathy, psychokinesis, Bigfoot and black masses, UFOs and Atlantis, Kirlian photography, cloning, and cryonics. These subjects all have one thing indisputably in common. People want to know more about them. For mankind's future on Earth and beyond.
Welcome to After Dark Radio with your host, Brian Alvarez.
How's it going, everybody? Brian Alvarez here on After Dark Radio, October 25, 2015, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are live here tonight after taking the last couple of weeks off for various reasons, and we have a very exciting show for our comeback here tonight. We are going to be joined by Matt Baglio. Matt Baglio is the author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, published by Doubleday in 2009. The book has been translated into over 18 languages. Adapted into a feature film in 2010 starring Anthony Hopkins. Baglio also served as a technical consultant on the film, which grossed nearly $100 million worldwide. We're going to be talking about The Rite here. From the website, Father Gary Thomas was working as a parish priest in California when he was asked by his bishop to travel to Rome for training in the rite of exorcism. Though initially surprised and slightly reluctant, he accepted this call and enrolled in a new exorcism course at a Vatican-affiliated university, which taught him, among other things, how to distinguish between a genuine possession and mental illness. Eventually, he would go on to participate in more than 80 exorcisms as an apprentice to a veteran Italian exorcist. His experiences profoundly changed the way he viewed the spiritual world, and as he moved from rational skeptic to practicing exorcist, he came to understand the battle between good and evil in a whole new light. Journalist Matt Baglio had full access to Father Gary over the course of his training, and much of what he learned defies explanation. Matt Baglio is going to be our guest on the program today. It's going to be a very, very fun time talking exorcisms, demons, the devil. Matt Baglio is a skeptic in the sense that he went into this as a journalist. He did not go into this as somebody who decided, I am going to study up on exorcisms. He fell into this story. He ended up writing the book, and he's going to tell you in a very rational, level-headed manner what it was that he learned when writing The Rite. That's coming up here in about a half hour here on the program. In the meantime, as always here on After Dark Radio, we've got a lot of news stories we can talk about here today. We're going to be taking your phone calls, Skype calls. We'll be taking text messages as well as emails throughout the program here tonight. So if you'd like to contact us, grab a pen and paper. If you're a new listener, I'm going to give you the numbers to dial. You can put these into your phone. You can give us a call anytime you'd like. And if you are outside of America, I'm going to tell you about something that's pretty cool. If you want to call us on a landline as opposed to trying to dial via Skype. I know that Skype is usually how people dial internationally, but I'm going to tell you a little trick that I figured out that came in very, very handy for me. the show. Studio line, 425-488-0525. Once again, to call directly here to the studio, the phone number is 425-488-0525. If you would like to Skype us, you're going to Skype to the phone line here, and my Skype handle is F4WOnline. That's F, the number 4, the letter W, online. And if you need this, if you can't figure it out, I know a lot of people sometimes write 4FW or W4F, you can always go to AfterDarkRadioShow.com. All of the numbers, the Skype handle, everything is up there on that website to text me. And do not call this number because nobody ever answers. Nobody ever checks the voicemails. It is strictly for texting. The phone number is 425-780-7566. My email address is brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. Twitter handle, @BrianAlvarez. The website, of course, AfterDarkRadioShow.com, with all of this information. And I want to throw out a plug for Andrew Lutsky, who is our admin on the Facebook page. If you go to Facebook and just search for After Dark Radio Show, there we are. Favorite us. If you want some strange news articles showing up in your news feed, no more than 3 a day, we will not bombard you. Andrew Lutsky does a very, very good job there. And Andrew also writes for culturecrossfire.com. He's got a new column up there right now. He's got new columns up there regularly. So if you go to culturecrossfire.com or just Google Andrew Lutsky, Lutzke, and get all of his columns, and he does a great job as the admin for the Facebook page as well. So head up there to AfterDarkRadioShow.com and check that out. We're going to head to the phones here in a moment, but first off, I want to read one article here. This is a big one. A lot of news has gone on in the last couple of weeks. I had a wedding that I had to go to, so I were off the air last week. The week before was just a nightmare week. Everything is back to normal and good to go now. Did a lot of upgrades to the studio here. Hopefully the show sounds better. But suffice to say, in the last 2 weeks, there has been a lot of news, a lot of things going on. And this one, I'm sure, did not fly under the weather, the radar here on the Dark Matter Digital Network, but it has elsewhere. This from NewsHour.com. Scientists at the Large Hadron Collider hope to make contact with a parallel universe within days. The staggeringly complex Large Hadron Collider Atom Smasher at the CERN Center in Geneva, Switzerland, will be fired up to its highest energy levels ever in a bid to detect or even create miniature black holes. If successful, a completely new universe will be revealed, rewriting not only the physics books, but the philosophy books as well. It is even possible that gravity from our own universe may leak into this parallel universe. The experiment is sure to inflame alarmist critics of the LHC, many of whom initially warned the high-energy particle collider could spell the end of our universe with the creation of a black hole of its own. So far, Geneva remains intact and comfortably outside the event horizon. Indeed, the Large Hadron Collider has been spectacularly successful. First, scientists proved the existence of the elusive Higgs boson, the God particle, a key building block of the universe, and it is seemingly well on the way to nailing dark matter, a previously undetectable theoretical possibility that is now thought to make up the majority of matter in the universe. Next week's experiment is considered to be a game changer. Mir Faisal, one of the three strong team of physicists behind the experiment, said, "Just as many particle parallel sheets of paper, which are two-dimensional objects, can exist in a third dimension, parallel universes can also exist in higher dimensions. We predict that gravity can leak into extra dimensions, and if it does, miniature black holes can be produced at the Large Hadron Collider. Normally, when people think of the multiverse, they think of the mini-world interpretation of quantum mechanics, where every possibility is actualized. This cannot be tested, and so it is philosophy and not science. But this is not what we mean by parallel universes. What we mean is real universes in extra dimensions. They've calculated the energy in which they expect to detect these mini black holes, and as noted, within a couple of days, they are going to fire this up. So far, the Large Hadron Collider has searched for mini black holes at energy levels below 5.3 tera electron volts. Latest study says this is too low. They are going to be, I guess, bumping it up and seeing if they can detect extra dimensions, create mini black holes, which obviously a lot of people are worried about. So we'll see what happens. A couple of days, we'll find out if there is going to be a major change, whether we make a huge discovery, whether the universe implodes. Maybe this will be the latest that we have been talking about here on this program, the latest end-of-the-world scenario. I guess we'll find out. Let's go to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
Hello, Brian. It's Eric from somewhere in Minnesota.
Yes, Eric.
I got two things. One about parallel universes, five stars.
That's right.
And two, I just want to call, well, since I didn't get a chance to call Art on Friday about on his Back to the Future lines, I thought I'll call and talk to you about my 30 years in the future prediction.
Oh, a 30 years in the future prediction. This should be good. I'll bet it has to do with time, right?
No, it doesn't, Brian. Surprisingly enough, my prediction is Brian Alvarez will go 6 days a week with After Dark Radio.
It's going to take me 30 years to get to 6 days a week?
You would hand over the keys to the F4W Empire to Vinny V, and he'll take over the F4W Empire when you continue the After Dark Empire.
I would guess that it's far more likely that I go 9 days a week and two new days are introduced within 30 years than Vinny ever takes over the Empire.
Darn, it was just a wild guess, I suppose.
Did you enjoy the Friday After Dark show?
Yes, I did.
Or not After Dark, the Art Bell show.
Yes, I did. Yeah, like I said, I wasn't able to call in because I was at work at the time, but I very well enjoyed hearing all the listeners call in and give their 30 years in the future prediction.
What was your favorite prediction from 30 years from now that somebody called in with?
I guess I can't remember too much, Brian, because I listened to the show last night, but yeah, just my memory kind of fades a little bit with time.
With the whole 24 hours of time?
Yes.
All right.
But one quick thing about the parallel universes. It'd be cool to possibly get a guest on and attack the parallel universes.
I can try to do that.
Okay, thanks, Brian.
We've got a lot of guest requests. We've got a lot of people suggesting guests. Obviously, the place to go is the Facebook page, since Andrew Lutsky is also working as a producer. I have two producers. Andrew Lutsky is the guy in charge of the Facebook page. If you contact him with a guest request, or if you think you should be a guest, we can try to set that up. He will send it to our main booker, Kenneth Nita, who's the guy that actually does all of the phone calls and everything like that, and he will hook you up. So Facebook.com/AfterDarkRadioShow if you have a guest request for the program. To the phones, you are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland.
Yes, Ryan.
I have a little guest story for you that my brother told me probably about 25 years ago when he joined the Peace Corps.
All righty.
It deals with this love potion this lady used to sell at the Marshall Islands where Jimmy Snook is from.
A love potion?
Right. Apparently there's this elderly lady that gives out the slut potion, then when she takes it, you see her ghost. But she's like real young, like 18, and she's naked. But she turns into like a really old lady, like her original form, then later. You heard like any ghost stories from like where Jimmy Snook is from?
I'm afraid that's the best one I've ever heard from that area of the world, Ryan.
Sidley, he's also seen a demon possession, too, of someone. He gained the power of 10 men when he got possessed by a demon.
Who?
Someone on the islands of the Marshall Islands got possessed by a demon, and my brother said that this man had the power of 10 men once he got possessed.
Well, interestingly enough, Matt Baglio's on the show tonight. He's going to talk about demon possession, and that is, in fact, one of the hallmarks of possession is when you possess the strength of many men and or women. So maybe your brother was onto something there.
Well, he actually saw it, so I can't verify it, but he said he saw it.
Saw it with his own two eyes, huh? Ryan, have you ever messed around with a love potion?
No. I know this one guy at the bar that says his buddy sells these rings that you turn into the water, and they said that they work every time that you use them, but I've never...
What do you mean, a ring that you drop in the water?
It's like a wish that you make with these rings, and usually you use them for like a love potion, like a girl you like, and they basically work every time. That
so you drop a ring into somebody's drink, and then they fall in love with you?
No, I think you got to like the lake and like make a wish like with them.
Huh. Wow. Well, Ryan, maybe next time you go to the bar, you can contact your buddy, and he can give you one of these rings. You can give it a shot and report back here. I want to thank you very much for the call. Studio line, 425-488-0525. The Skype line, F4W Online. Text us at 425-780-7566. And all of these numbers and such are up on the front page of WrestlingObserver.com. We'll also be taking your Twitter messages. For those of you that are regular listeners to the Dark Matter Digital Network, you know hashtag DM Talk. It's the one we use here on this program. Will here says Ryan has to be a gimmick. If he wasn't, he would call Art's show as well and not just Brian Alvarez's show. Maybe you're right about that. Jason from British Columbia, a regular caller here on the show on Twitter, says he is traveling in a remote and dark area of Russia. No cell service here, but he sent me an email to update me on the alien situation. So, he can't call. I suppose he could call via Skype, right? If he has internet but no cell service, that's how I normally do it. And by the way, I wanted to mention this. If you're overseas, I had never used Google Talk before, but Google Talk is free, and I was unaware of how it worked, but I was trying to contact Matt Baglio, our guest for tonight, and he is in Rome, and I was not about to call long distance to Rome, and so first I was going to Skype him, and that wasn't working. I tried to Skype his landline, and for some reason that wasn't working, and I'm racking my brain trying to figure out how to get a hold of Matt. And suddenly I thought, well, I got this Google Voice account. Let's see how this works. So went up to Google Voice, and in order to call a landline in Rome, I am here in Seattle. The cost to call a landline in Rome was 1 cent per minute. And the way it worked was I logged into my Google Voice account, and I typed in his number in Rome. And what happens is they call your telephone, and when you pick up, they then connect you to the landline in Rome. So I had him on a landline connection, which sounded amazing, from Seattle to Rome for a penny a minute using Google Voice. So if you ever need to call somebody on a landline, Skype isn't working, or you don't like the Skype quality, check out Google Voice, because the rates are very, very inexpensive, and the connection is great. Which also reminds me that next week on the show, we're going to be joined by Nicholas De Leon. And I remember this because he is also on Google Voice, and his phone also sounds unbelievable. He's going to be on next week. He is our regular tech correspondent. We usually have him on every 2 or 3 months, and he's going to be on talking everything tech. So if you've got questions, maybe I will set up an email address, or I'll allow you to email in questions, and I can ask you some of the questions that you have about the latest in tech. But I usually have more than enough to talk for a full hour, and it's always one of my favorite shows because I love tech, and there's always so much awesome stuff going on. So that's next week. Nicholas De Leon is going to be here on this show talking technology. And, of course, if you're a big fan of tech, that will be the show for you, the Apple. I know the latest Apple deal just occurred. I forget what it's called. All of the new stuff, but we'll be talking about that. Jason from BC here has, in fact, sent me an email. And so let's find out what's going on in his life. He says, I'm traveling in a remote area of Russia right now. I'm unable to call. The aliens that I've spoken about before, the one I saw outside of Phoenix, it looked like a hairless bear, which spoke bad French, has been visiting me in my dreams. I mentioned in the past, he has been shoving a cornucopia into my ear and talking to me in English. He continues to visit me in my dreams. He asks, quote, "Do you understand me?" I try to answer, "Yes," but no sound comes out of my mouth. Now he has begun telling me, "You must eat the lamb." And he spells out lamb for me, but he spells it incorrectly. He spells it L-A-M-B-M-M-M. I have tried to work out various things that L-A-M-B-M-M-M could stand for, but have not really figured out what this alien is telling me in my dreams, if he's even trying to tell me anything, and I'm not just losing my mind. That is from Jason in British Columbia, who has in fact been keeping us abreast of this strange situation, this alien that is allegedly visiting him in his dreams. Got a lot of other interesting news articles we're going to talk about later on today. This one is from masslive.com. I bring this up only because I have never taken this seriously, what I'm about to talk about here, but apparently it is being taken more seriously by a lot of researchers. Is Bigfoot an extraterrestrial visitor? Now, first off, this requires you to believe in Bigfoot and extraterrestrials. Or actually, maybe it's even easier. Maybe you only have to believe in one or the other. Bigfoot may be an extraterrestrial, so that's only one cryptid or one paranormal being that you've got to believe in, as opposed to two. I've always figured, if Bigfoot exists, and I'm skeptical, but if he exists, it's probably some sort of flesh and blood creature. I don't believe that Bigfoots come out of UFOs, whatever, but this article here, is it possible the creature known as Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or a number of other names all over the world is an interdimensional traveler? There's a theory now in play from both Bigfoot and UFO researchers, and one that played heavily in a discussion at this weekend's Greater New England UFO Conference, which is something that I've got to go to one of these days. There's a Sasquatch Summit that is going to be coming up near my home, and I'm going to be checking that one out, which is coming up, I believe, in November. Paranormal researcher William Hall at the convention, ostensibly to talk ghosts, said the paranormal world as a whole is more connected than people realize, but that is beginning to change, at least from the perspective of those involved in ground-level research. It used to be that the UFO people didn't talk to the ghost people because they were a little weird, he says, and nobody would talk to the Bigfoot people because they were crazy. I found out we cannot continue to do that. In reality, quantum physics is leading us there. It is not a new theory. Dr. Franklin Rule, writing for the Huffington Post, says such sightings date back to the late 1800s. In the modern times, it is a theory that dates to 1973, but one that is grabbing hold as more and more Bigfoot hunters are reporting run-ins with what is known as the orange orbs, fast-moving lights that one may think are alien in nature, but often seen in areas associated with Bigfoot. Renowned Bigfoot hunter Bill Brock was the first speaker at the conference, and the first of the weekend to raise the idea about multi-dimensional portals. Brock referenced a recent NASA announcement that magnetic portals may be real. He said he came to believe in them when he traveled to West Virginia to study the Mothman case. Buddy says are mysterious orbs transporter beams for Sasquatch. Bill Penning believes it is possible. In his first recognized Bigfoot encounter, something large in the woods shook the ground, but vanished quickly. In addition, he found a set of tracks that seemed to indicate something appeared behind a running deer very quickly, caught the deer, and then disappeared because both sets of tracks ended at that point. Portals could be why we don't see any bodies and why there are no bones, Penning said. Here's the deal. In my opinion, it's not just me. Nobody knows for sure whether Bigfoot exists, whether aliens are visiting the Earth, whether there is any such thing as ghosts. I know that there are people, if you watch Finding Bigfoot, which by the way is coming back for another season, Bobo has seen Bigfoot, he says, with his own eyes, and therefore he believes. Now, realistically, Just because you've seen what you believe is Bigfoot with your own eyes, that's not proof that Bigfoot exists. We have no proof that there is any such thing as Bigfoot. We have no proof that there is any such thing as UFOs. We have no proof that there is any such thing as Bigfoot. Now, maybe all of these different things exist. I don't discount the possibility. Maybe all of these things exist. But since we cannot prove the existence of any of them, if you are trying to look at this as a scientist, which all of these researchers claim that they are, then you can't discount anything. You may personally feel, like I do, that if Bigfoot exists, then it's probably an animal. But we don't know. And therefore, you can't discount that maybe, if Bigfoot does exist, maybe it is an alien. Maybe it is a ghost. Maybe it is an interdimensional being. Maybe it's a Loch Ness Monster. We have no idea. If you're going to look at this from a scientific perspective, you can't discount anything. So, I don't know. Personally, I think it's ridiculous, the idea that Bigfoots are alien beings coming out of UFOs or coming in and out of other dimensions, but it could be the case. We don't know, and it is nothing that can be discounted. Matt Baglio is our guest here today. In just a moment, he's going to join us here on the program. Matt Baglio is the author of a number of different books, including The Right, which you can check out at Amazon.com. He is a New York Times best-selling author. He is also the author of Argo, the true account of the 1979 rescue of six American hostages from Iran. Matt Baglio is our guest today. He's going to be talking The Right, The Making of a Modern Exorcist. We will be talking demons, the devil, exorcisms, spirits, and so much more. Matt Baglio is going to be joining us right after the break here on After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. Very happy today to be joined by Matt Baglio, the author of The Right, The Making of a Modern Exorcist. It is available on Amazon.com, Kindle, hardcover, paperback, Audible, audio CD. Find booksellers everywhere. Film made on the topic. Matt, how are you doing today?
Great, Brian.
It is not every day that I get to call, I believe, Rome. Is that correct?
That's right. I'm over here right now in Rome.
I believe this is the first time I've ever called anybody in Rome for a radio show, actually. And it sounds very exotic. What is life like in Rome?
Well, it can be exciting. It can be boring. I mean, it's just like anywhere, I guess. When it comes to covering the topic of exorcism, it's kind of ground zero in a weird way, but maybe not so weird when you consider that the Vatican is here and there are lots of churches and priests and pilgrims coming here all the time.
Now, the reason I asked about life in Rome was I was hoping you would have an answer of sometimes it's exciting, sometimes it's not, because that does in fact tie into the story of exorcisms as written about in your book. I was amazed. I kind of knew that much of what you hear about exorcisms, you watch The Exorcist, you see stuff in Hollywood, and they make it up to be more than it often is. But when I read in your book that there are essentially, it's almost like going to the doctor's office, and you explained it in exactly that way, where sometimes an exorcist will see 10 patients a day. You go to a waiting room, you get a card, you sit down, there's like an appointment. It was astonishing to me. I guess let's start there. The story of exorcisms is not as exciting as it's made out to be in Hollywood.
Well, it can be. I mean, that's a short answer. It can be. Those cases are rare. And here in Rome, where there are a concentration of, there is quite a concentration of exorcists, they do see lots of people. So they do have waiting rooms, and it is very bizarre. I mean, when I first began researching the book, I didn't know anything about exorcism at all, and I assumed it was going to be a topic that not many people would want to talk about, that I would have a hard time finding exorcists, and they, you know, everyone hears about exorcism, and it's always a case that happened 50 years ago, or that happened, you know, somewhere in some far-off location, and Instead, it was happening every day here in Rome. And so I went down to see one of these exorcists, and there was, you know, 15 people in this waiting room, some outside, you know, coming and going. They all weren't there to undergo an exorcism. Some were people who were family members there to assist and these kind of things. And so that was my first sort of introduction into how bizarre the reality of this world really is, because these people would go in, it would be over in 20 minutes, and they would come out. And while I was waiting to go in myself to interview the exorcist and to participate and watch some of these exorcisms, you know, I was sitting next to these people, and you couldn't tell anything was off about them. They were just like me. They were dressed in some were very fashionably dressed. There were, you know, and I had an exorcist tell me this. They're lawyers. He sees lawyers. He sees doctors, actors, musicians, lay people, anyone. They all go to see an exorcist. Then it's a repeat process, which is why they come back and why they're why the exorcists see them so often, why the exorcisms aren't quite as long.
You mentioned at the beginning of the book you're basically recounting the story of an exorcism, and it was striking to me in that as you're describing it, there's a girl on a table, and as you're writing about it, you offhandedly mention that she's wearing a Puma sweatshirt and that her hair is tied back. And it was that little detail that was, it really kind of struck me as this is a modern thing with normal people. It was just, I don't know, when I saw that vision in my head, it was like it could be anybody walking down the street, but this was a person who claimed that they were possessed by a demon. It's really an astonishing thing. Before we get into this more, I want to go backwards just a little bit and talk about you and how you went from, I guess, whatever you were doing before to covering the story of Father Gary Thomas. How did this all begin for you?
Well, I mean, basically, I was just a journalist, and a lot of journalists heard about this course that was being offered at this Vatican-affiliated university, you know, that purported to train exorcists. So that was my initiation into the world of exorcism. I didn't know much about it. I'm not exactly a fan of the genre. I'd seen the film The Exorcist, and I was raised Catholic, but I wasn't a practicing Catholic at the time. So I was curious, and I went down to this course having no idea about what to expect, you know, thinking in my mind a lot of the misconceptions that probably most of your listeners have. Oh, this is a taboo subject, and how would they teach this in a course? You know, would people graduate? Would they be praying the ritual over people in front of a classroom of students? And, you know, when I got to this course, I saw it was very different than what I expected. There was a psychiatrist who was teaching the course. There were these priests who were very sophisticated and saying, you know, the exorcist has to be the ultimate skeptic. Lots of the theology about what demonic possession is and the history of the church I knew nothing about. I found that to be very fascinating, very different from what I expected. And then I met this American priest, and that was really what started it off. He was this open, engaging man who himself didn't know anything about exorcism. That's another interesting topic. There are a lot of priests out there who don't believe in this topic at all. And, you know, as a lay person, as a lapsed Catholic, I can say, yeah, well, I may not believe in it myself, or I may believe in it, whatever, but as a priest, how can you say you don't believe in it? So that was interesting to me, that there were priests, and here was an exorcist. Father Gary Thomas was appointed as an exorcist, and he didn't know anything about it, and he'd never been taught anything about it. So he was very open with me about that, and I asked him, well, can I follow your journey and document what you learn and interview, you know, all the people you go and see? And he gave me the permission to do that. And then on my own, just because I'm pretty curious by nature, I went in to talk to these exorcists and sat in on exorcisms. I'm pretty sure this was many years ago. This was in 2007, 2006. I don't think there were many outsiders who had been given that access, and I think it was just my willingness to want to tell the truth. And I was very open with these exorcists. Look, I'm going to write this book, but I want to know the reality. I want to know what really goes on.
You mentioned you'd seen the film The Exorcist. Did you ever read the book?
I hadn't read that book. I did read Hostage to the Devil and a couple other books about the topic, you know, and there are very few, I would say, accurate books out there that aren't written in English. When I did my research, I had to read a lot of books in Italian. A lot of the exorcists who were teaching the course and who knew what was really going on in this world, they'd written books, but they were all in Italian. So I read a few books in English just to sort of see what was out there, but I didn't really find anything in English that was matching up to the world that I was seeing here in Rome and the experiences that Father Gary was having when he went back to California and all of that. So I tended to read lots of books in Italian.
I remember that I read the actual book, The Exorcist, and I just was blown away by this book. I thought this book is the best book ever. And then I went and watched the movie, and the movie is a great movie. It's very well received. But after reading the book, I was so disappointed in the movie. And I'm sure that anybody that's a fan of anything, if the book's great, then the movie's going to be a disappointment because obviously there's so much stuff that's cut out of it. There are things that are changed. The thing that I loved about the book that we didn't get a lot of in the movie was the big, long rigmarole of essentially having to prove that this girl was truly possessed by a demon and not suffering from some kind of psychological what have you. And, of course, you write about that, and that's a big, that is an important thing that I think we need to talk about here. In the...
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that was one of the aspects of becoming an exorcist that the Father Gary was most concerned about. You know, I want to know that this person is actually suffering from a demonic possession versus having some kind of psychosis, a mental illness. And that was really stressed in the class. You know, the exorcist has to be the ultimate skeptic. You have to work with mental health professionals. And I think that a cautious approach was one of the things that opened up my mind to the fact that this, it could be something real to this phenomenon. Because if you've got a fundamentalist type guy up in front of the course, up in front of the students, telling them that all the problems out there are because of a demon, I would instantly start to become, you know, suspicious of that. Instead, you have a person up there who says, first, you know, send them to a mental health professional. Psychiatrists, psychologists, you know, they have to be screened through science. And so it really was an approach embracing science. It wasn't excluding science. And it wasn't the exorcist up there trying to convince the person that their problems were caused by a demon. It's quite the opposite. And that, to me, is very interesting. And again, many of the exorcists, what they'll do is they'll have this screening process. It's very involved, as you described. Some of them have gotten quite good at it, so they may be able to have sped it up, but they don't have these powers. They're not magical, you know, they're not magicians. So they interview the person. They start to suspect that maybe there's something more going on. They send them to a psychiatrist, psychologist, and then, you know, slowly they'll begin to proceed with some kind of prayer, perhaps ease into the ritual. There are, of course, other exorcists out there. Father Amoris is one of them who tends to jump right into the ritual. He claims that, you know, there are certain demons that will not be manifesting unless the ritual is being prayed, because the ritual is a very powerful prayer. But for the most part, those are rare, and the church would really rather have priests screen people carefully through psychiatrists, psychologists. And in a lot of cases, people are coming to see them after already having gone for years to see other specialists. So if they're undergoing psychiatric treatment, if they're on medicine, the exorcist has to, and this was again stressed, the exorcist cannot tell them, stop taking your medicine, your problems are spiritual in nature. Those are things that the exorcist has to avoid. But I interviewed several people who said, look, I'm an atheist. I don't believe in any of this stuff. I've been going to specialists for years, and my problems did not go away. And they described to me what was going on in their life. They had all these weird phenomena happening, you know, terrible nightmares, things moving around the house, objects disappearing, appearing, pains and joints, knees and things that they started to lose functionality in their legs. They couldn't walk. And they went to specialists for years, and the doctor said, we don't know what's going on. Finally, somebody suggested, go and see a priest. And they went to see an exorcist. The exorcist began to proceed with his discernment, and then he said, you know, okay, well, why don't I do a healing prayer? He began to do the healing prayer. The person fell on the ground, they went into a trance, and then the next week they could move their legs again. So, you know, and again, I'm asking these people, I'm talking to them, and you have to believe that they're credible or not, but if it was just them, if it was just one person who told me that story, then I probably would tend to say, well, they could be definitely exaggerating. But I interviewed so many different people, again, not religious people, people all across every spectrum, and they pretty much told me the same thing. So that there's something interesting here. And again, though, the exorcist definitely has to be certain that it is not a mental illness, because the last thing you want is a priest to go in and tell somebody that their problems are caused by a demon when it's clear that they're suffering from schizophrenia or something else.
You mentioned earlier that there were a lot of, and still are, I'm sure, a lot of people working in the clergy that know nothing about exorcisms. And part of the reason for that, I'm sure, is what we've just been talking about. There are, I'm sure, a number, probably most, who feel that the rite of exorcism is this antiquated deal, and exorcisms throughout history have usually been performed on people with mental illness, schizophrenia, whatever. And over the course of the last several generations, the belief has been that that's what this is, and therefore exorcism is not something to be taken seriously. You don't learn about it when you're going to seminary or whatever. Is that sort of the feeling that you got from talking to various people?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the church, within the Catholic Church, there's this division. There are the more modern-style priests who don't believe in personified evil. They think the devil is just a metaphor, and then you have the more traditional style priests who believe, no, the devil is a personified figure. You know, he can do certain things, and so there's this division, and it's interesting. You could probably look at the church, you know, going back to the 1970s when modernity was coming into the church. There, where the split happened, where you had priests who said, "Look, we know mental illness exists, and we think that, you know, people were probably misdiagnosed in the past and claim, you know, that they were said to be possessed by a demon when it was clear that they weren't, which is absolutely true. So let's just throw the whole thing out." And then you have more, you know, modern priests who say, well, that's really not what we're doing. And I think another aspect that creeped in was the portrayal of exorcism, and this is something that a lot of priests kind of shied away from because of the sensationalism around exorcism and the misconception that the whole reason that we believe in these things of demons, etc., is to get out of being responsible for our actions. So, you know, many people will criticize the whole notion of demonic possession because they say, oh, well, it's just a way for people to say, you know, I didn't do it, a demon made me do it. I didn't, you know, cheat on my spouse, a demon made me cheat on my spouse. I'm not an alcoholic, a demon made me pick up that drink, et cetera, et cetera. Well, if you talk to the exorcists and the theology in the church, it doesn't work that way. That's exactly the opposite of how it works. The person is completely responsible for everything that they do. You cannot say at the end of the day, oh, you know, a demon made me do it, and that theologically made sense to me. You know, if you believe in an afterlife, if you believe that at some point you're going to stand before God and be judged for the sins that you did when you were alive, you can't say, oh, well, I didn't do those sins, the devil made me do it, and then God said, yeah, you're right, you know, you come on in. So theologically, that doesn't make sense. So what the church really teaches is, no, it's through the actions that a person, you know, performs that could open themselves up to some sort of evil influence, and then it's a process then that they will continue to turn away from God and continue to be influenced by this evil. But it isn't the evil that is controlling them. They're allowing themselves to go down this path. So I think this misunderstanding as well, and then the idea that the exorcism is not a magic ritual. It's not that the priest doesn't snap his fingers. And again, I think many people have this idea that, oh, it's a battle to the end, and if the priest loses, the demon wins. No, it doesn't work that way. It's a process, and it's about the prayer weakening the influence that that evil has over the person, so that the person themselves can retake control over their life, and they can return to God, return, you know, come back away from the evil, so to speak. And I think when you think of it in the, along those terms, it becomes less of an extreme thing. Of course, Hollywood doesn't portray it that way. They portray it as a, you know, an action movie. There's everything's going on, as you mentioned earlier, the film The Exorcist, very dramatic. And I think when people think of exorcism in those terms, they're immediately turned off by it. And then there's the other side, which are people who are too apt to believe in the presence of evil, that the demons are responsible for everything. And again, there are denominations out there, including certain Christian denominations, who I think have perhaps embraced this idea that, you know, the devil and the demons are constantly interacting and controlling us and causing us to do sin and these kinds of things, and have exaggerated this a little too much. And so priests have seen that and said, well, you know, that's too extreme. So, you have extremes on both sides kind of creeping in. You have the priests themselves who are trying to embrace modernity, which they should. And all of that works out in the way that the church would like to see an exorcist today. Again, Father Gary as a representation of that approach, how they would like them to proceed with an exorcism, which is use psychiatrists, use modern science. And I've talked to psychiatrists and doctors and people who say, I help exorcists. I'm a board-certified psychiatrist. I've seen thousands and thousands of patients. I know what schizophrenia is, and this is not it.
It's very interesting. You make this comment in the book about, as you talk about all that right there, modernity, trying to bring this into the 21st century. How about that? And at the same time, there is the famous saying, something along the lines of, the devil's greatest victory is convincing humanity that he does not exist. And essentially, in a lot of ways, if you believe that the devil exists, then he has succeeded in a lot of ways, because there are a lot of priests nowadays that do not believe that he exists.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that there is this idea behind the approach to the devil. I mean, if you look at in antiquity, the church never doubted the existence of the devil as a personified entity. When you get into modern times, that view has changed. I think my personal opinion is that priests are right, you know, to be skeptic about emphasizing the demons and the devil. I think that approach to faith, for me personally, is sort of coming at it backwards. You know, it's sort of kind of scare people into believing into God. You know, even the Catholic Church, when you look at the efficacy of prayers and what's important, let's just say, among the rituals of the Catholic Church. And again, I focus on the Catholic Church just because my research was based on this Catholic priest. I'm not trying to say that the Catholic Church is the only, you know, entity out there that can perform exorcisms and nobody else knows what they're doing. No, that's not what I'm saying. So I'm just trying to say that my expertise is more in the Catholic approach to exorcism, because that was Father Gary Thomas, was a Catholic priest. But you have priests out there who are really not necessarily emphasizing the devil, and this is for good reason, because the Catholic Church says that the sacraments are more important. So communion, confession, you know, and practicing your faith is actually more efficacious than an exorcism itself. You know, the ritual is kind of an emergency intervention, but if you're practicing your faith and you're being a good Catholic, then a Christian, if you will, then you will, you know, you should be okay. And so priests, in a way, by emphasizing the positive aspects of the faith, I think they're doing the right thing. I mean, you don't want a priest out there who's too obsessed by the devil, and so it's hard for the average priest, I think, because, and even for exorcists, you've got to be knowledgeable, but in a way that you can calm people down, because and as weird as it sounds, the general public is more into exorcism than the priests are. It is more willing to believe that angels and demons are involved in our life and affecting our lives in a certain way. So it's up to the exorcist to say, you know, to calm them down, just like any expert. When you need an expert opinion, you may have self-diagnosed yourself from the internet, as most people do today, but when you go to see an expert doctor, you expect that he's going to give you that expert opinion, he's going to calm you down. And it's the same with a priest. You know, you want a guy who's trained and knows how to look, what to look for, but more than anything, is calm, is going to instill that sense of calm in you. And for the most part, that's what the exorcists that I talked to were like. You know, if you go to a priest and he's, you know, oh, don't touch me and don't come near me and can I catch it and all the things that aren't real and all these exorcists, the real exorcists tell you, you know, it's not a disease, you can't catch this, it doesn't mean that the person's evil, you need to just calm down. That's what you want. So, but again, this is a long answer to it, probably a short question, but priests are, I think, smart not to emphasize evil, but at the same time, you know, they need to also kind of be aware that it's a part of the faith, and if you do believe in the faith, you need to know how to address it.
Funny that you mentioned that, because I hadn't even thought of asking this question, but now that you mentioned, can it be contracted? Jesus performed a lot of exorcisms in the Bible, and in one of them, he sent, the demon itself or the devil or whatever, requested to be sent into some nearby swine, which then ran off the side of a cliff or something. I don't remember the exact story, but that was an example of transferring. The spirit, the demon, whatever, went from one body to another. So, I guess talk a little bit about that. The process from what you have talked to people about, I mean, whether you personally believe this or not, just from what people say, I mean, I guess contracting possession, I mean, if you're in the same room with someone possessed, I mean, it's not like you're both going to become possessed, or is it? And can it be passed from one person to another?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the biggest misconceptions out there. And if you read Malachi Martin's book, Hostage to the Devil, he hits that pretty hard, this idea that you've got to be careful when the spirit is being cast out because it could come into you. And that personally is, according to the exorcists I talked to, again, this isn't my opinion, these are the experts out there in the field, they say that's absolutely 100% not true. This isn't a disease that you can catch. This is it's a personal thing that's going on between an individual and this quote-unquote evil spirit. So it isn't a disease. And when you're participating in an exorcism, when you're in the room, now granted, I didn't see some of these stronger cases, and there are some very strong cases, and you mentioned The Exorcist, the film. What was not believable about the film The Exorcist was that girl in the film manifested all those symptoms in one case. But individually, exorcists will see a lot of those different symptoms. They'll see, you know, they won't see the head spinning around, but they'll see the eyes go up and vomiting and all sorts of the guttural voice. I heard that myself. Very uncanny. But you know, this isn't. I think I lost my train of thought. What was the
casting from one to another?
Oh yes, absolutely. Sorry about that. Yes. So this isn't a disease. You can't catch it. And when you're in a room, this is what I wanted to say, when you're in a room and you're seeing an exorcism, even if it's a kind of a violent exorcism, you have a lot of empathy for the person, and you see that they're suffering, whether or not you believe it's true or not. They are clearly suffering. They're undergoing something. Most of these people have been ostracized. You know, they've been cut off. They're sad, and they just have, it's like they're wearing this cloak of heaviness about them, and they tell you that nobody believes my problems are, you know, everyone thinks I'm making this up. So when you're in the room, you have a lot of empathy and you want to help the person. You're not thinking, oh my gosh, is this thing going to come into me? Don't get away, you know, get away from me. And again, that's what exorcists tell me. No, it's not a disease. You can't catch it. The person isn't inherently evil. You know, it's like, oh my gosh, this person has been possessed by a demon. They must be evil. No, it's it's a process. It's not an exact science. I mean, that's the best answer I heard from an exorcist who told me that, look, this is it's not an exact science. You know, everything is up to God. God's in charge. And a lot of people may think that's strange. You know, if God exists, why would he allow the devil to possess people? And that is a great question. And I put that to theologians, and they said, well, the best answer we can give is that in the end, God wins out, and that these people may suffer, but other people around them will increase their faith, will come back to the church. And it's a journey. So the person, again, what's happening, and we can go into the causes of what exorcists say, so, you know, what causes this kind of thing to happen, but the gist is what's happening is that the person has turned away from God, and they've embraced things that have turned their focus away from the light, and they need to return that focus to the light. And it's when they want to turn back to God that the demon starts to stop them from doing that. And it at first can tell them, you know, you're not suffering from a demonic possession. You don't need to see a priest. It's like, you know, trying to get them to not go to see a priest. The last thing they want is for the person to go and see a priest. So then eventually the person goes and see a priest, and then he performs a discernment. He let's assume that he is confident that the person is suffering from spiritual problem. And then he begins to perform the ritual, and then slowly they will manifest these symptoms that, you know, some of your listeners may be familiar with from movies and or minor symptoms, you know, yawning. That's one that I saw a lot.
Yeah, you mentioned burping. That some of these people, they only had a cough.
A cough, coughing, burping, some sat absolutely still. And then slowly they show signs, but what's important is that they begin to kind of get their life back on track. So they stop having these bouts of sadness and things that are the demon has been bothering them in some way. Like the woman we talked about earlier who had the Puma tracksuit. You know, I interviewed her. I was sitting next to her, and she told me about her life and how, and she was this sweet, you know, woman who was probably in her mid-20s. She was there with her older brother and her mom. We were chatting, and she was telling me what she was undergoing. And, you know, she just was timid and shy. And she, it was like clear that she couldn't figure it out either, you know, what was happening. And she woke up one night. She felt this slap across her face. She was sleeping, and her eyes opened. She felt this presence in the room. She started to look around, and you know how your eyes slowly focus, and she started to see these insects appearing on the walls. And they were all misshapen, she said. You know, one had didn't have an antenna, one had only one wing. And she called her mom in, and her mom came in, and they started smashing these insects with the shoe. And they were laughing as they were telling me this, you know, kind of like a laugh, and how ridiculous is this? And then the insects would just keep appearing all over the room as they would smash one and one would appear over here and all these things. So these things happen to these people, weird things like that, you know, objects would disappear. And so they get really sad and they get really desperate. And they need help. And so they, you know, go to see an exorcist but it's a process again. So the person will, through the power of the prayer, will begin to be able to go back to church, be able to pray again and return to, you know, have it. And then slowly this influence will go away. I mean, another misconception people have is that when a person is quote unquote possessed by a demon, this demon will be inside them. Have like, you know, you could have an x-ray and you could see like a little black dot or something. And there's the demon over there. It's not like that. I mean, if you follow the teachings of the Catholic Church, these are spiritual and corporal beings. They don't have a place. They don't exist anywhere. They don't have a physical body. Where they are is where they act. So if the doors are opening and closing on their own, it's because it's acting on that door to open it and close it. But it isn't physically there. That changes when the ritual starts, and that's why you get these strange reactions. Because what's happening is that, and I had one exorcist tell me, it's like these entities are connected to people like a tube. Picture like a long tube. And this entity can have more than one tube going out to different people. And when you pray the ritual, though, and the entity is connected with this tube, and it's sending these inputs, you know, through the tube. It doesn't, it's not present in the person, but it can influence them, their thoughts and, you know, images and these kind of things. But when the exorcist prays the ritual, then it's like the power of the prayer will suck that entity through that tube, and then it becomes present in that moment, and then you get these really strong reactions, and that's when you hear these stories. And I saw a couple strong reactions when the eyes will roll up and you'll see the whites, and the person will speak in different languages or understand different languages and can exert can thrash about. And one exorcist said he saw a woman levitate, you know, just all sorts of any kind of that strong phenomena will happen then. And then what happens is that after an hour or after 20 minutes, however long the exorcist will pray the ritual, he will break this moment, stop the ritual. The demon will then, the entity, whatever, will then go back through the tube, will disconnect. But slowly it will have less control over that individual, less inputs that it can send, until finally that connection, that tube, is severed. And that's how these guys, again, the Catholic exorcists that I interviewed, that's their approach to exorcism. So it isn't a one-shot deal. It isn't from dawn until, you know, from midnight until dawn. But other denominations, they have a different approach.
You know, one of the things from the book The Exorcist that I thought was so great was, it's like a game. And this, of course, this is a fictionalized account, obviously. This is not, I mean, you can talk about how things really go, but, and it's odd that I'm looking at this from the perspective of, if I were the demon. The idea seems to me, and it was in The Exorcist, that it's like a game where the priest's job is at first to try to prove beyond any shadow of a doubt that this is not a demon. That's the whole idea. You're trying to find a rational explanation for this. And there's also the aspect of it that it would seem that the demon would not want to manifest itself in such a way as to prove that it is a demonic entity, because then the exorcism is going to take place. The game would be that the demon wants to do what it's doing while at the same time leaving enough doubt that a person could say, okay, this is a case of schizophrenia, this is a case of mental illness, because really the demon does not want to be cast out. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's basically the dynamic as how the Catholic Church teaches exorcists, you know, what's going on, that the demon doesn't want to reveal itself, so that in the extreme cases, it will even... Again, I had people tell me this happened to them, will physically stop them from going to see the exorcist. So the car will not work. You know, they'll have a flat tire. Anything can happen. I'm not going today. I have this appointment. You know, we all get those moments where, you know, we decide at the last minute to flake out on something. And it's kind of like an extreme version of that. So it's telling them that their problems are caused by mental illness. It's telling them not to go to see an exorcist. The last thing that it wants them to do is go and see an exorcist. So that is kind of the process from the other side of it. And yes, from the side of it, from the priest, it's trying to exhaust those natural explanations, always having to do that, you know.
Now, this would be a difficult game, because if you're trying to exhaust the natural, if you're trying to exhaust all possibilities, if you're trying to find what you believe is evidence that this is merely a psychological issue right here, I mean, if you presume this is real, the demon should, in a lot of ways, be helping the priest to make that decision.
Yeah, I mean, it's trying to hide, and I think that it's something that the priest has to work at. They need experience. But again, if a person comes to see an exorcist and a priest, any priest, they don't need to be an exorcist. Exorcists have to be appointed by the bishop, but any priest can perform a blessing. So the priest can say, look, you know, you need to see a psychiatrist. Have you seen one? Now, again, assuming that this person hasn't already been to see doctors, because they may have already been to see many doctors, and they may have said, I've been to see doctors for 8 years, 3 years, whatever. Nothing's helping me. I don't know why I'm here. Those, again, are usually the cases where the exorcists begin to suspect there's something more going on. But they may pray a blessing. It doesn't need to be the ritual. The ritual is a very specific prayer. It's very suggestive. And that's why the exorcist has to have the permission from his bishop, and he has to be morally certain in his mind that this is a real demonic possession. So, it could be infestation, it could be an oppression, something like that. So, but they can pray a blessing. They can just say a regular blessing. And usually, if this person is suffering from some sort of spiritual ailment, they will, according to what the exorcists tell me, they will manifest a sign. They will show something that will alert the exorcist that he should proceed cautiously, but he should still see the person. So it is something that is a gradual thing, but the exorcist should know in some way that something is hidden there. That person should have an inadvertent reaction to, again, an aversion to the sacred is one of the signs that exorcists look for. There are many. The most dramatic are, you know, the ability to speak foreign tongues, ability to know things, secret things, and unnatural strength. So those are the more dramatic ones that really come out later under the ritual. And the aversion to the sacred is kind of the main one. On the flip side, exorcists often use tricks to weed fakers out. And then I talk to exorcists who do this a lot, where they will have a person come to them. And usually the people that they start to weed out right away are the ones who say, I have a demonic possession. Right
sure.
away. They know that's probably not true for the reasons that you just mentioned, that the demon likes to hide. So they will say, really, you know, you probably don't. Or they say, I'm cursed, or whatever it is that they say. The exorcist will say, okay, well, I'm going to pray this prayer over you, and we'll see what happens. And then the exorcist will read a page out of a Latin novel. So they'll, because the prayers in Rome, they pray in Latin. So these guys all study Latin. They have books in Latin. So they just pick up a regular book, not a prayer, and read a phrase in Latin. And the person will react, you know, oh, it's stop, you know, I can't take it anymore. Or they'll use unblessed water and say, okay, here's some holy water. And they'll throw the unblessed water on them, and the person will, oh, this is burning. And they know they're faking. So they do these kind of tricks. And sometimes they'll do it, and the person will laugh and say, you know, I know that's not blessed water. Or you can, you know, take those black
sure.
Pages and shove them somewhere else because they're
yes.
not doing anything for me. So there are these games, as you put it, going on.
But at the same time, let me stop you right there. If I were a demon and you threw fake holy water on me, and as a demon I'm aware that the holy water is fake, I would scream because I would be wanting you to think that I'm faking it.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that could happen, but on the same token, it's connected to other things, and it's a process. It isn't a one shot deal, and it isn't an exact science. So again, could people be fooled? Yes, and the exorcist could say nothing's wrong with you, and then they leave. But eventually, they'll come back. Eventually. They will come back if they do. If they don't, then that's terrible. But you know, it is something that exorcists are aware of. But of course, they would rather err on the side of caution. And you know, not every exorcist is the same. Some exorcists pray the ritual under their breath. Some say prayers in their mind. Usually, if they suspect that something's going on, they have ways of stimulating some kind of reaction. That's what I was told by exorcists. And they, again, if they see people, they've seen thousands of people, and most of the people that come to see them, 90%, according to what they tell me, don't need an exorcism. So 90% right away, nothing wrong with you. It's those 10%, and they're kind of focusing in on that. And as you say, the ones, according to what exorcists tell me, the stronger demons are the ones that want to stay hidden the most. And so they may pray the ritual. I had one ritual that I watched, and the woman sat absolutely still. Absolutely still. She did not make any move at all. Like rigid, just sat there. And then afterward, the exorcist told me that that's a very, very strong demon. And he told me it was because it would, you know, it just wouldn't manifest. And I asked, well, how did you know that she was possessed? How do you know she's possessed by a demon? And he said, well, you know, she came to me from another exorcist. He performed this long discernment process, and he had talked to the family, and he'd figured it out. So I couldn't say 100% whether or not it was true or not, but that's what it's like. There's a lot of gray out there, so that's why exorcists have to err on the side of caution.
Now, you mentioned Hostage to the Devil, Malachi Martin. He did Art Bell's show many, many times. Very, very popular guest. Was he a well-known figure among those you talked to? What was the overall feeling about him?
Yeah, he was not a well-known figure among any of the people I talked to. I would say that he was more of a figure back in the 70s and 80s, and we know when his book came out, than he is today. Most of the exorcists today didn't really know him, and he left the Catholic Church. I think he's a very controversial figure among Catholics, especially among priests and exorcists. So I didn't talk to many of them. And his name brought his name up. They didn't reference him as an expert. I read his book, and I can say that he definitely participated in exorcisms. I never interviewed him. I interviewed a couple of exorcists who Father Labar was one who knew him and had helped him way back when. And he, I think, if I remember, this is a long time ago, I think he spoke well of Malachi Martin in the sense that Malachi Martin was around when exorcism was kind of really on the outs. There were not many exorcists out there. Today it's much more out in the open. There are many exorcists, and exorcisms going on all the time. I mean, again, this is not something that happened 50 years ago. So, but having read his book, having seen exorcisms, my personal feeling is that there was a little bit of exaggeration in his portrayal of what was happening. Very easy to say that this priest is being tempted, and to, instead of saying he was tempted by this, to sort of describe it in the most graphic way of a force that is pushing him and forcing him to do things. I think that he knew his stuff. I don't doubt that. But I think that he, rather than try to say something negative about him, just say that his approach to exorcism, I think, was maybe trying to sensationalize it a little bit more than my approach. My approach was trying to bring it back to the sort of academic side of what is it that exorcists are actually doing today? How do they perceive exorcism? And I think Malachi Martin was more about exorcism in the 70s and 80s rather than in the, 2010, 2015.
Going back to the girl in the Puma shirt, when you tell the story about her exorcism, you're telling it from all sides in the sense that you're telling it from the side of what the witnesses would have seen, and you're telling it a little bit from her side. And you mention, for example, she looks over at the wall and she sees whoever. And I guess my question is, if I were possessed and I was undergoing the rite of exorcism, what would I remember from afterwards? Is it a situation where, I mean, I presume from the way you told the story that when I woke up, I'd remember everything that happened. Does it vary from person to person? Do some people remember the whole process and what they saw? Do some people remember nothing, and it's like they woke up from a long sleep and they have no idea what happened?
It's different, and everybody's different. Some people remember, some people don't. Some people, it's like they're watching themselves on a TV screen. Some people have complete blackouts. One woman, I can't remember if it was a woman that was wearing the Puma outfit or not, but a different woman was sitting in her living room. She told me this story. She was sitting in her living room next to her husband, and they were watching TV, and the husband turned the channel, and, you know, in Italy, they often will put the Pope on the news or something like that. Pope came on the TV, and she said, from that moment, she woke up, and she was on her bed looking up at her husband, who was trying to protect himself, and he was looking kind of very frightened, and she said, "What just happened?" And he described how she had completely started freaking out. And so she didn't remember having done that. Now, the woman who I interviewed, you described the exorcist and I described in the book. Yes, I interviewed the exorcist. He told me his side of the story, what he was seeing and praying moments of the ritual. And then I interviewed the woman and her mom, who was in the room. She told me her side as well. So I got as much as I could. And again, I can't say if those things were really happening. She was claiming to have seen Mary and I think it was Saint Gemma Galgani and Mother Teresa and all these figures in the room, and that was what she claimed to have seen.
That's right, Mother Teresa and the Pope when they were young.
Yes, that's right. There was a Pope in there as well. And, you know, it's possible that the exorcist was using those figures as part of his ritual. Some exorcists will interject various saints, and Mary is popular among exorcists. And, you know, he could have auto-suggested that. That's a tough one. But she was one of many who said that they saw things. So I don't think she was necessarily trying to convince me. She didn't really care. In fact, she looked more kind of bewildered about what was going on. And I found her to be genuine. I didn't think she was making things up. But she underwent that experience. She remembered it. She said she could see it. But other people know. Other people forget. And again, those are the stronger cases. Really, one out of, let's say, 100, or maybe even more than that, are having these kinds of reactions. Of the less than 10% who come to see an exorcist, most people are sitting there, they're yawning, they're coughing. They may smack the hand away of the exorcist. He puts his hand on top of their head, or touches their top of their head with his stole. They may, you know, smack that away. But then afterwards, they're having fun, and they're not necessarily having fun, but they're back to normal, so to speak. You know, it's kind of like a quick pick me up. I had a case where I watched this woman, and this was one of the strong cases in my book. And this was a case that Father Gary followed, and this was a nun. And she had the strongest reaction, and she had a voice that was just really uncanny. It sounded like the voice, like a dog speaking. And I knew it was her because I could hear her. She would smack her head against the back of the wall. And the exorcisms were performed in this really small room. And it was, you know, the lower portion was like almost like a tower, very, very tall, but kind of narrow and small, so that the person would sit in a chair, like a metal folding chair, and then the exorcist had a couple chairs that would face that chair, and they would be, you know, 3 feet away, and they were both touching the walls. So it was kind of a narrow place, and the back of the wood, this low wood panel, was all scratched up. And so when I saw that, I said, well, you know, something's been going on here. You know, like the height of the back of the chair, like the person had, was rubbing it against the wall. And I heard her, I heard this heavy thumping, and I realized that was her, you know. And then she, as soon as I heard the thumping, which was basically her trying to smack the back of her head into the wood wall, and her, she was with her companions that were then had to stop her from doing that. I heard her speaking in this very dark, guttural voice and, you know, cussing and responding to the prayer, because that's usually what happens. The exorcist is praying the ritual, and the ritual has certain phrases, very suggestive. Again, you know, the Jesus defeated you in the desert, whatever it is, and the person will laugh. Oh, do you believe that story? And so they're reacting to the prayer, and they're trying to shake. They're just focused right on the exorcist. They don't care about anybody else in the room. And afterwards, she came out. I was outside the room looking through the door. After she came out, and she was sitting on the couch, and she looked like she'd run a 10K. You know, she was exhausted. And I sat next to her on the couch while I was listening to the next exorcism going on, looking through the door again. And she was, and I remember the priest, he came up to me and he said, "You want to know about exorcism? Ask about demonic possession. Ask her." And she smiled in this kind of whimsical, not whimsical, but wistful sort of shy way. And she was a completely different person. I mean, such a, it was hard to look at her as she was and picture that person who was in the room making all that noise and trying to smack her head against the wall. It just was very strange. And I didn't feel in danger. I didn't feel, oh my God, I'm sitting next to this person. What's going to happen to me? It's very hard to describe, but there's a human element to it. And that's why when lots of people talk to me about exorcism and they say, well, I'd love to, journalists especially, film, you know, they like to film an exorcism. And it's hard, I think, to capture it on film. You know, there's a human element to it when you're there.
A couple of final questions here, then we'll start plugging the book. Let's talk some percentages here in terms of if you had 1,000 people go and claim that they were possessed. I think the numbers you had were something like 95% would be, it's something psychological, it's schizophrenia, it's whatever. And then you've got the remaining 5% that really can't be explained that way. And of that 5%, there's only an even smaller percentage that display anything that could be described as supernatural. What small percentage would that be? And what are some of the sorts of things that you're talking about that could be described as supernatural? And what did you see?
Yeah, well, I mean, the small percentages are people. There could be people who have issues going on in their life who could be need a blessing. Now, some exorcists will use the ritual. The church would prefer that they don't for a blessing. But these are the people who have yawning reactions, or they may cough, just, you know, like something's caught in their throat. There's a lot of those people, and the smaller percentage are the stronger cases. And the exorcist, again, now he has a waiting room, but for the stronger cases, he may schedule them all on one day, you know, just one person one day, and it may be 2 hours long. These people tend to have the most reactions. And again, during their life, they won't necessarily manifest these. They're not like the girl from The Exorcist with cuts and look like a demon walking around. They look like a normal person. And again, they're not evil and they're not dangerous. It's an internal struggle. They are suffering inside with themselves. They're not out to hurt people. So they may be sitting there. They may look down. They may look sad. And you can start to see, oh, it looks like maybe something's going on here. And then, so they will tell you what happened, what is going on during their life. And it can be these strange phenomena, you know, they'll have objects disappearing. Again, one woman would made a cake or something and it was gone and she found it up on top of the cupboard. One woman had this rosary with beads, like a beautiful rosary with these glass beads. And she went out of the room, she came back in, the rosary was hanging on the door and there were no beads on it. And she couldn't find the rosary beads, and then she went around the house and she found them in the back, outside the house, a little crushed in this fine little powder in the little mound outside the door. They'll hear noises, they'll hear voices, and all these things are basically driving them away, trying to convince them that they're crazy, trying to push them farther away from having a human connection, from love, from the church, from God, from the light, so to speak. They'll go to see the exorcist. They'll have these strong reactions. Now, these are the cases where I had exorcists tell me some pretty amazing stories. And again, they're in the book, of cases where a person would vomit nails. That was in the movie, actually.
Wow.
The vomited nails that dissolved into this like black goo. One person vomited up a live toad that when the exorcist went to catch it, it dissolved into some sort of black goo. They will secrete things from their arms like a film. They vomit so much fluid that it doesn't seem that it would be possible. They have a natural strength. The woman I described earlier, the one who was banging her head against the wall, she bent the legs of a metal chair. They can speak. They can have these weird reactions where the exorcist will. I had one exorcist tell me that he went in to see a girl. She was probably 19. She was sitting in a chair facing away from him, and the exorcist, he spoke French, and this was in Italy, so he was talking to the mom, and the woman was facing away, and he said a prayer in his mind in French, you know, just sort of, while the mom was telling him something, he just thought, you know, say this quick little blessing in French and see what happens. And instantly, the person turned around, faced him, the eyes went up, white, and the gruff voice, the girl said, it's useless that you pray in that language because we know them all. And the eyes going white is this aversion to the sacred. So it's not, the demon doesn't want to look at the priest, so the eyes go white. That's what they say. So they can have these strange reactions. I had an exorcist tell me he saw a woman levitate, but those are very rare, and I didn't see any of that. That was another part of your question. I didn't see any case where I said, wow, I can't explain that. That goes beyond my, you know, ability to explain that in a rational way. I didn't see anything like that. But I did interview enough people, again, atheists and scientists, psychologists, priests, people undergoing exorcism, people assisting, people who just had nothing to do with exorcism, but they had these experiences in their life. You know, when you do a research, a book like this, and you start talking to people, you'll find that many people out there have had some kind of experience. They just don't know, they can't explain it, they don't know what it is, but it just has that kind of an uncanniness to it. And again, talk to enough people where I was able to come to some degree of confidence that there is something in these very small amount of cases, there's something going on. And I don't know what it is. I'm not going to say there are demons, but that is what the church believes, and that's what exorcists claim is going on. And these entities are leaving these people alone after they undergo exorcism. So, and they're coming out under the prayer. And again, this isn't just Catholic thing. There's exorcisms are practiced in the Amazon, in Africa, and most native societies have an idea behind, you know, spirit possession and casting spirits out, as well as the main major religions of the world.
Matt Baglio is the author of The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist. It's available at Amazon.com, Kindle, hardcover, paperback, Audible, audio CD. And before we go, Matt, I want to give you an opportunity to talk about any other projects you're working on. I know you've written other books as well. Obviously, the film. What are you working on these days, and how can people find out more about you?
My other book was Argo, was about the CIA operation in Iran. Sorry, the rescue of the six house guests from Iran. That came out a couple years ago, and I'm working on another project with the same individual, Tony Mendez, and I've been working on a couple other projects. So hopefully those will be coming out soon. My website is a pretty good place to go to, www.mattbagley.com. Otherwise, hopefully they'll be tuning in to your show.
Some very, very different subject matters being covered here. Argo to the right.
Right. Well, I'm a very curious person. I mean, when I started to do the exorcism book, I didn't know anything about exorcism, and I think that I've always been a guy who's attracted to this idea of overturning expectations and understanding the truth. And even with Argo, it was a story about using ingenuity. The CIA was a fake Hollywood movie production company in order to rescue people. It was completely intriguing and a way to portray spies that I'd never seen before. Same with exorcism, and trying to portray the reality of the world that many people don't know anything about. Even though those books have both been made into movies, and I'm a fan of movies, I think that a lot of people do get their impressions about the truth from movies, and that's not always a good thing. So I've always liked to have a movie come out, but say, go and read the book and to learn the reality behind the film.
Well, like I said, if you've ever seen The Exorcist and you've not read the book, I recommend everybody go read the book and read The Rite as well. It's an awesome book, and I don't know if anyone has ever compared it to Moby Dick before, but I'm going to do that right now, in that it is a great story, And mixed up in the story is a lot of historical data about what people thought about the devil throughout the ages, possession, stories. It's a very, very good book. The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, mattbaglio.com is the website. And Matt, I want to thank you so much for doing the show today, and hopefully we can get you back on again sometime.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Brian. My pleasure.
And of course, thanks everybody for listening. We'll be back in just a moment with more After Dark Radio here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. We are back here on After Dark Radio. Brian Alvarez here, After Dark Radio on the Dark Matter Digital Network. I want to thank Matt Baglio for his appearance on the show here tonight. MattBaglio.com is the website, and of course the book, The Rite, The Making of a Modern Exorcist, available at Amazon.com, fine booksellers everywhere. Head up there and check it out. If you've got any questions, comments on the interview, you're welcome to give us a call here tonight on the program. Open lines from now until the end of the program. Studio line, call me direct, 425-488-0525. Once again, that's 425-488-0525. If you'd like to Skype us, F4W Online is the handle. Text messages to 425-780-7566. Once again, text messages only to 425-780-7566. My email, brian@afterdarkradioshow.com. The Twitter handle, if you'd like to follow us on Twitter, is @BrianAlvarez. And, of course, the Facebook page, facebook.com/afterdarkradioshow. All sorts of great stuff up there, so check it out. A lot of news to get into here today. We talked earlier on in the show about the Large Hadron Collider attempting to make contact, so to speak, with another dimension. And I was looking around at the news as the interview was taking place, and a couple of stories caught my eye. These are all linked up, by the way, on the left-hand side of AfterDarkRadioShow.com. We link to the feed for Unexplained-Mysteries.com. They always have good articles up there. And a couple of them caught my eye. We'll get into some of the other stories I had prepared for tonight as well. This one, for those of you that listen, the pro wrestling mixed martial arts tie-in, all of you, this might interest you as well. Our ability to make a fist and strike an opponent with sizable force might be an evolutionary trait. Scientists have long maintained that our hands evolved to give us the manual dexterity needed to make and use tools, but now researcher David Carrier and his colleagues at the University of Utah put forward the idea that our ability to punch may have played an important role. To reach this conclusion, researchers carried out a series of bizarre experiments that involved swinging deceased human arms into various punching targets in a laboratory. Keep in mind, by the way, things like funding. They took deceased human arms and swung them into various punching targets. The rather gruesome research effort required a total of 9 donor arms, each fitted with a series of special sensors that were embedded in the bones and muscles, a procedure that would have been far too damaging to carry out using living test subjects. By using the arms to strike a target in a variety of different ways, researchers were able to determine that a clenched fist is simply the safest and most effective way to punch something. However, not everybody is convinced the human hand evolved with this behavior in mind. I think a lot of the criticism we get from a fear that any evidence of aggressive behavior having been important in our evolution somehow provides a justification for bad behavior, says Carrier. Rather than justifying aggression, an improved understanding of who we are, of human nature, should help us prevent violence of all kinds in the future. Earlier we had a call. Art Bell on Friday was doing his Back to the Future line, Back to the Future Day, and we had a caller earlier talking about his predictions for the next 30 years. What do you think is going to be happening in 30 years? Are we going to reach the point where we all live forever? We can upload our brains, our personalities, into a computer chip and live on long after our bodies have died? What is your prediction for 30 years from now? Unexplained-Mysteries.com has an article here. What will humans be like in 1,000 years? A new science video has been exploring what might become of our species over the next few centuries. In the animal kingdom, species are changing all the time. Humans are no exception. Even over the last 150 years, we have seen mankind's average height increase by around 10 centimeters and our average life expectancy rise by more than two decades. I did just see an article that stated that the first person who may live to be 1,000 years old may already be alive today, which is very interesting to me because A, I'm alive today, and B, my unborn daughter is not yet alive today, but she will be come February 27th, and maybe she will be one of those that lives to be 1,000 years old. It says, what is likely to happen to us over the next 1,000 years? Will we even be recognizable? Transhumanism, the use of technology to repair and enhance our bodies, could eventually play a major role in many people's lives. Tiny robots called nanobots could swarm around inside us on a permanent basis and help such things as removing artery blockages and fighting diseases. Bionic augmentations could improve our eyesight. By the way, it's already taken place. I had LASIK. I had horrendous vision. I had vision so bad that when I was young and I had to pass the eye test to get my wrestling license, Washington State would not allow me to be a professional wrestler in a predetermined wrestling act if I had vision bad enough that I needed glasses. And so there was a book that I read. There was a series of books. It was Big Secrets, Bigger Secrets, and Biggest Secrets. And I thought the books were great, but in the books was an explanation that all eye charts are the same. And so I memorized to 2020. First one is the big E, FP, TOZ. You keep going down. And I believe the final line, if I can recall, was DEFPOTEC. I had it memorized. That's how I passed the eye test. And later I went and I got LASIK, and the rest is history. I've got 20/20 vision now, 2015, I think, in one eye, or 2020 and 2025. Anyway, got perfect vision due to LASIK, so that has already been augmented. Augmentations could make us physically stronger, boost our brain power, enable all manner of enhanced superhuman abilities that do not occur naturally. So if you want to check out this video, it's up at unexplained-mysteries.com. What will humans be like in 1,000 years? Let's go to the phones. You are on the air. Who is this and where are you calling from?
This is Dave from Wisconsin.
Dave, you sound like you're asleep.
No, I'm fully here.
Well, what's happening?
Well, I want to first tell you that nothing will make you taller outside of that mystery surgery from Southeast Asia that you have to spend 6 months in a bed for.
Well, I'm not doing that. I'm telling you that right now.
Well, I think that would severely impact your bottom line. But anyway, I wanted to call to see if you'd heard about this video of the plague doctor threatening to take the U.S. President Barack Obama's life.
I have not seen this. Tell me this story.
Well, I had first heard about this by, granted, just being bored online and searching YouTube top 10 lists, and someone had this video of a individual dressed in a plague doctor, which looks—it's a beak mask, essentially, like a bird beak, or
sure,
looks very similar to a pelican mask. Just to for people who aren't familiar with plague doctors from the Middle Ages, basically, it has a bunch of cryptic messages in it, and one of them essentially threatens to kill the president. It's a you can just search plague doctor on Google, and I'm pretty sure it will come up. I know the Daily Mail has an article about it. It originally allegedly surfaced on a tech called the
Oh boy, you're cutting out, or the government's cutting in, one or the other.
Well, I hope it's not better.
This is creepy.
The video itself.
Oh man, they're getting to Dave.
It's undergone extreme analysis to spectrum.
Oh man, Dave, they got you, buddy. He's gone. Well, Dave, you know my email address, so send me an email with whatever you've got right there. And if you can, I have people on Twitter here asking what your Twitter handle is. So if you want to give that out to the world, let me know, and I will let the world know. Dave in Wisconsin's Twitter handle. Unless that person asking for it is also a government agent wanting to get your information as you talk about this plague video. If anybody has any more information on that, go ahead and tell me. I haven't seen that yet. I guess the big question is anybody taking it seriously? Because there's a lot of weird, wacky stuff on Twitter and on YouTube and Facebook and everything else that, man, I have friends that live and die on these YouTube videos, these conspiracy videos up on YouTube, and always tell me the latest crazy thing they saw on YouTube. And I don't want to sit here and say that none of it is legitimate, but it's YouTube. Any crazy person can put together a video on YouTube. So I don't know if it would be high on my list of, I don't know. Anybody has any information, let me know, but I'm somewhat skeptical of all of this. I'm sure it exists, but not sure how much stock we should put into this particular video, but I don't know anything more. A unique watch worn by astronaut David Scott during the Apollo 15 moon mission has been sold at auction. He wore this on the moon. The winning bidder paid $1.6 million for a scratched watch that was worn on the moon. There is also a wristband covered in lunar dust. $1.6 million. Scott had worn the watch on the moon as a replacement when the NASA-issued Omega Speedmaster timepiece he had been using broke following his first two moonsaults. Moonwalks, I apologize. Among the decisions I made, the monitoring of time was perhaps the most important, he said. So there you go. This person also wants to know if you've heard from David, our correspondent. We had a correspondent that would call the show every single week, David, and he was doing all sorts of investigations of various things, and some of them were getting kind of weird and wacky, and I told him to be careful. And the next thing you know, we haven't heard from him in months. Now, if I recall correctly, we stopped hearing from David around the time that we moved to Sunday nights. So it is possible that Dave's work schedule no longer allows him to call after midnight on Sunday nights while he was able to call on Friday nights into After Dark Radio. So I don't have an update. I don't know whatever happened to David. If anybody has any idea, David, if you're listening, I know you're, I've seen you here and there on Twitter, I believe. If you've got an update, feel free to let me know, or better yet, give us a call tonight. All of the numbers up on the front page of AfterDarkRadioShow.com. If you'd like to drop us a line, that is the email address. Got a lot of other articles here. I saw this a few weeks ago, actually. I want to ask everybody about this because this was a big deal to me when I was a kid, and I saw an article on it, and I was intrigued. Do you guys remember the Mysteries of the Unknown, the Time Life Mysteries of the Unknown series? There's a big article on these books up at atlasobscura.com. It says, turn on just about any channel of American TV between 1987 and 1991. There's a pretty good chance you would be treated to strange tales of spontaneous psychic connections that were dismissed as coincidence, or a normal-looking guy talking about a magician's honeymoon in the Great Pyramid before harping on his friend to read the book. You might even see a young Julianne Moore telling a story about an out-of-body experience. They were all commercials for Time Life's Mysteries of the Unknown, a mail-order book series that not only blanketed the airwaves with unforgettable commercials, but captured The Imagination of a Burgeoning New Age Explosion. The book series was a collection of thin black volumes that delved into every corner of the mystical, metaphysical, and paranormal. But for all of their admirably in-depth explorations of everything, from earth energies to mysterious creatures, one mystery remains. How did they get so popular? How did they get so popular? They were awesome. Now, I've never bothered to look this up. I just thought about this right now. I'm sure it's online. If anybody can point me to it, that would be helpful, but otherwise I can Google it tonight. Is there a list out there of all of the Mysteries of the Unknown books? Because this is going to seem like a weird tangent, but it'll make sense. When I was a little kid, every day I would wake up to go to school, and before I went to school, I would have my breakfast as I was getting ready, and there was a cartoon on television, and I watched it every single morning. It was called Star Blazers. For those of you that are around my age, you probably remember fondly Star Blazers. I'm 40. Every day there was a new episode. It was episodic cartoon television. I loved Star Blazers, and I would watch every single episode of this show. And there was the final episode. And for some reason, maybe I would get sick, maybe something went wrong and I slept in, I don't know. But the point is, over all of the years that I watched Star Blazers, I always missed the final episode. We didn't have DVRs back in those days. We didn't have VCRs. If you missed it, too bad. You had to wait for the entire series. I'm sure there are younger people listening to this right now thinking, my God, well, first world problems, number one, and number two, what a terrible world to live in back in the early 80s. But yes, if you missed one episode of Star Blazers, you had to wait for them to replay the whole entire series again before you could see the final episode. I've never seen it. I bet you anything it's online somewhere. Realistically, I would have to watch the entire series again to be hyped up for the final episode. Maybe someday I'll do it. Maybe if I live to be 1,000 at some point, my daughter and I will watch all of Star Blazers front to back. But the point is, I always miss the final episode. Now, the tangent there ties into this. Mysteries of the Unknown had all of these commercials, and they would show all of these different books that you would get if you subscribed. They would send all of these books to you, and I forget exactly how it worked. It was, you know, 2 decades ago or 3 decades ago or something like that, but something like, keep the ones you want and return the ones you don't. And to the best of my knowledge, I never returned any of them. I've got the entire series here at the house. All of these Mysteries of the Unknown books. I don't know if they're worth anything or not, but I have them. They still look great. They're awesome. But the point is, I seem to recall, and maybe I'm wrong, I seem to recall that there was one book that I always saw in the commercial, and I was always waiting for that one to be delivered to me. Maybe it had to do with monsters. It was either monsters or UFOs or Bigfoot. It was one of those. It wasn't any of the psychics, ghosts, or anything like that. I think it was one that had to do with monsters. And I waited and waited, and every month a different book would come, and I waited and I waited, and if I recall correctly, I never got it. So if there's a list online, I'll print it out, and I want to go downstairs, and I want to look around, and I want to see if I truly never received that book, and then maybe I can go and find it someday, but I just remember they would come like once a month or something like that, and I was always so excited. My mom would say, oh, your book is here, and there it was, Mysteries of the Unknown. And granted, I was mostly into Bigfoot, UFOs, and monsters. I didn't care much about ghosts. I didn't care much about psychic activity. So a lot of them, I'd kind of get it, and I'd go, huh, you know, that's cool, kind of flip through it, and then pretty much just wait for the next one to arrive. But man, I love those books. I got the whole series right here. If you want to read more about Mysteries of the Unknown, you can go to atlasobscura.com and you could check out a story on all of those. There was another one that I think was put out by Reader's Digest. I have this one too. Might have been called Mysteries of the Unknown, I can't remember exactly what it was called. I'm pretty sure it was a Reader's Digest book, but it was a lot thicker. It wasn't like a series. It was one book. And man, I loved that book. And I think I talked about this after I took the trip to Alaska. But they had a library in Alaska. And there's a lot of, I don't know if it's just old people or tourists or there's just no young people that live there. But there's plenty of old people in Alaska. And so when I went into the library, I was amazed that it seemed every single book was from the 60s, 70s, or 80s. It's like there wasn't one new book in this library. But I grew up in the 70s and 80s. And so all of these books that I remembered when I was a little kid were here in this library. There was the Mysteries of the Unknown. There were these Time Life books. There was this Unexplained Mysteries or Mysteries of the Unknown, whatever it was that this Reader's Digest book was. But I was just in heaven here in this library, but it was cool. If you ever get a chance to check them out, especially if you're a big fan, I would recommend it. Dave in Wisconsin, I almost read his real name right here, he emailed me. He says, I'm okay. I am unsure what the interference was. He has links to the Daily Mail. If you want to Google it, creepy video featuring masked figure, cryptic clues, death, White House baffles internet. So I'll click on that as soon as the show goes off the air. And he also has the original link with more information. This creepy puzzle arrived in our mail, it says. Which sounds like something I'm going to have to check out here. Also, he says, I do not use Twitter. And he says, I may use one if there is some sort of demand for whatever reason. So I guess if you're a listener and you're really intrigued to hear Dave in Wisconsin's sleepy thoughts on a variety of issues, maybe he'll set up a Twitter feed for you. But as of right now, Dave in Wisconsin does not, in fact, have a Twitter for the person who asked about that. Also, we don't have time to really get into this, but I want to lead everybody to the Washingtonian, washingtonian.com. There's a great article up there by Matt Blitz, if you want to Google it. The scary, weird, somewhat true story of the Fairfax Bunny Man. It says, often with urban legends, there's a story and there's the truth. That's what makes the tale of Fairfax County's Bunny Man so eerie, bizarre, and downright creepy. Several versions of the urban legend splashed across the furthest reaches of the internet. The true story of the Bunny Man may have been even weirder. A creepy guy on Halloween dressed oddly throwing hatchets at people. It's just too bizarre to possibly be true. This is up at thewashingtonian.com. And finally, at thecopycateffect.blogspot.com, you can Google this as well. Phantom Clowns of 2015, Copycats of 1981. We've done mini shows talking about the Phantom Clown Flap of the early 80s. These alleged men in vans dressed as clowns trying to kidnap children, which seemed to be more hysteria than anything else. But it appears that we may be back. Phantom clowns stalking St. John's Road in Kent. Daily Mirror reporting that clowns and vans chasing terrified children, spark warning, go straight home after school today and not loiter. Exactly like the phantom clowns of the early 80s. We are out of time, everybody. I want to thank you so much for listening. If this is your first time hearing the show, we are live every Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network. This show is going to be available as a free replay at our website, which is afterdarkradioshow.com. If you head up there at this exact moment, if you're listening live, you can grab the October 4th show with Nick Pope talking UFOs. That was a great show. Head up there and grab that. This show will be replacing it in about 15, 20 minutes or so. And again, we will be here next Sunday night, 9 Pacific, midnight Eastern. I want to thank all of you for listening. I want to thank, of course, Keith Rowland, the great Art Bell, all of you as well. We'll talk to you again next time with a brand new show, After Dark Radio, here on the Dark Matter Digital Network.
onward sped, I shook my head, and I gazed with a feeling rare. And I said, says I, to a passerby, who's the maid with the nut brown hair? He smiled at me, and with pride says he, that's the gem of all Ireland's crown. Young Rosie McGann from the banks of the Ban, she's the star of the county down. And from Pantry Bay up to Derry Kay, and from Galway to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like the sweet Polly that I met in the county down. Fair, she'll be surely there, so I'll dress in my Sunday clothes, with my shoes shine bright and my hat just right, when the heart of the nut brown rose. No pipe I'll smoke, no horse I'll yoke, and my plow will rust and brown, till a smile by my own fireside sits the star of the county down. And from Bantry Bay up to Derry Kay, and from Galway to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like the sweet Colleen that I met in the county down. And from Bantry Bay up to Derry Kay, and from Galway to Dublin town, no maid I've seen like the sweet Colleen that I met in the county down.